Hey, Adam.
Yes, Mike.
There's so many things that I would like to say, but thankfully I have gained a slight level of maturity over the years, so I am going to keep those
You
things
have?
to
Did
myself.
that take place between the last show that we recorded and today?
That's, within the last 30 seconds of starting the show, I figured it was better to keep some things closer to the vest and to not say some things that I want to say, to get off my chest, to vent about when that is not what this show is here for. You know what I'm talking about, my man?
I think I do. I think I do.
New Japan, Stardom. There are so many good things taking place in the world of wrestling. And yes, did I limit it to those two things? I did. Noah fan, All Japan fan, Dragon Gate fan, other fan. Not because we don't want to talk about those things, but because we are limited on time, and they are the two most pressing things that we could talk about today. Adam went, he cracked open the forbidden door. I don't know if he went in the back door or busted open a side door, but he got in. He was in the building. And as well, we've got the five-star Grand Prix that has started up, some great matches that have recently taken place with Stardom. So we have a full day. Nobody needs to hear me bitch and kvitch and whine and complain, especially about
I don't
others.
about what?
Others.
Yes, I was in fact in the United Center for the Forbidden Door pay-per-view in the F4W section, as it were, some four rows off of the floor, dead center, great seats, and a very, very good show that I got to see live with my close, longtime personal friend and Wrestling at Random podcast co-host Jeremy Deamer. I don't want to sound negative because this was an awesome show, and it was so much better than it had any right to be given all of the injuries on the AEW side, given the injuries also on the New Japan side and the limitations in terms of not everyone coming over that you'd like to see come over. See Tetsuya Naito for further details. But I would say, I guess this is a controversial take to say that this, to me, this fell just short of an all-timer, which is fine. And not everything has to be the best show you've ever seen or the best match you've ever seen.
No,
This
you're
was.
wrong. It's an all-timer. No, you're wrong. I was told I was wrong. No.
God, I feel like it's Twitter come to life in my ears.
Ugh.
This is a great show. And we'll talk about it in detail. We can go through it. I mean, the pre-show was awesome. There was really nothing bad on the show, unless you want to say on the pre-show, if you want to nitpick and say that Lance Archer and Nick Camarada was bad. I thought it was perfectly fine. I don't know why it needed to exist on this show, but it was perfectly fine. I don't know that there's ever been a show where the IWGP title or IWGP world title match was maybe the worst thing on the show. But yeah, I mean there's not a lot bad that you could say about this show. To me though, a show that is an all-time great show, it needs to have something on it that's like a clear match of the year candidate, if not a clear match of the year. And while this show had a lot of really good stuff, a couple matches that I think you can make an argument were great, I don't think that there was anything on this show that was, that really got into that, to me, top 10, top 15, top 20 of matches I've seen this year.
Yeah, or something groundbreaking that takes place on the show that you've never seen before. Or, obviously, in the case of when worlds collide, it's just the fact that it was a groundbreaking show and went off better than expected and all of those sorts of things. And I just think this is a great example of a show where why can't it be a really good show that everybody seemed to have a great time at and watching? And especially after all of the headaches and the literally limping into this pay-per-view with the amount of injuries that are taking place, the final, kick in the pants being Hiromu a day before he's scheduled to fly over, the day of he's scheduled to fly over, gets to the airport, his temperature is too high to travel, and it's like you throw your hands up, and it's like, okay, what else? And then the thing takes place. Everything really goes off pretty much without a hitch. Everything goes well. It's a good show. The crowd was fantastic.
Oh, that crowd was incredible. Yeah, that was, I mean, that, in a lot of ways, that carried the show. Again, there was nothing bad on the show, but the crowd reactions throughout, not only to just, you know, guys' entrances, but reactions throughout. And one particular moment that I know a few other people have referenced as well in the main event that was among the best moments that I've been in attendance for in my now 30 plus years of attending live shows. The crowd carried it very well. The, you know, one thing that was notable from the very beginning of the show that while this, you know, it's an AEW crowd, this was a crowd that by and large knew who the New Japan guys were, particularly the top stars, and saw them as such. There were a few guys, one guy in particular that, given the reactions that some guys got earlier on the show, I was a bit surprised that this one wrestler didn't get as strong of a reaction, but I think it's also indicative of the fact that there were probably a lot of people there who had been fans of New Japan up until the point that AEW started and then drifted from New Japan, you know, and they maybe weren't as familiar with guys or one guy in particular that had become, you know, a significant player in the company over the past few years when maybe they hadn't been watching quite as much.
Yeah, the atmosphere and the aesthetics matter. And the atmosphere that the fans bring to AEW shows, that's one of the things that they still really have going for them. And one thing that was certainly learned with this show is if you are excited about the thought of AEW and New Japan working together or are just a fan of New Japan talent and wrestlers and that style, you're going to buy your tickets first day. Like, yes, you're getting them in the first 2 days. We know that now because we obviously see what the secondary market did and all that sort of stuff, and that really doesn't matter. I mean, we can get into it if you wanted to, but
well,
that doesn't really
matter.
Well, we
should mention, though, because, yeah, I saw, you know, the secondary market, all the talk of, you know, $4 tickets on StubHub in the 300 level. And all that was true. I saw all those things as well. But in the building, like, we were pretty much on the floor. Like I said, four rows behind what would be the benches if you were, you know, if the boards were up, the ice was in, and this was a hockey game. And, you know, looked up, looked around, and there were very few empty seats. So either people bought those $4 tickets or the people that had them up for $4 ended up eating it and showing up, because outside of a few stretches of empty seats in the lower bowl and some scattered throughout the upper, you know, the 300 level, the upper deck of the United Center, it was jam-packed.
That's good. That's good. And I don't know how much of the pre-show you want to talk about. Really, the only thing that that was the sign that the crowd, you knew the crowd was going to be incredible because...
Well, the sign was very clear. The sign was that when Yoshihashi came out, people lost their goddamn minds.
And I think
back to the Ring of Honor show several years ago in Chicago where Kenny Omega, even though he forgot to bring the IWGP US Heavyweight title, He came and he defended it against Yoshihashi, and Yoshihashi got no reaction. And here, the people were so excited to see him and Hirooki Goto make their entrance and defeat the Factory. So, yeah, that was when it was obvious that not only was this crowd hot, but this was a crowd who they knew who a lot of these New Japan guys were.
Yeah, and I wondered, I did a spot with ESPN Austin Stu Myrick. I love going on his show, and I had to eat some crow doing the post show because I was thinking, look, if you were going to buy this show and you were going to watch this show, you, when it came to the pre-show, you know, I don't think we were going to get a lot of drifters. I don't think we were going to get a lot of people on the fence. You know, I think people had made up their minds by last weekend, and I think the numbers that have come out have probably borne that out. But I will say, if there was anybody on the fence, as soon as that pre-show started and the fans are going bananas, and like you mentioned, Yoshihashi goes out there and QT Marshall, because the people hate him so much, he's such a cartoonish heel for AEW fans to boo because he's been there since day one in the Cody stuff and all that stuff. It was perfect, and it was a great way to kick off. So it was like, you know, if there was anybody on the fence, 99% of them probably said, all right, F it. You know, I'm in on this. I'm spending the time to do this now. I'll wait on watching the BET Awards or whatever else was going on that night. This is what I'm going to do. And the second match with Archer and Camarado that I know some people jumped on, this is where I go to my, I've been watching wrestling a long time and we have to analyze the business game. Nick Camarado would be a much bigger star in Japan than he would be here at this point.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny that you mentioned that, because the people around me were actually saying the same thing.
Yeah.
That like Camarado, he's kind of a big guy that's just there, but he's totally the guy that, you know, you send to Japan. I mean, Ric Fuller got a tag team title run with Giant Bernard, if I'm not mistaken. Nick Camarado, give him 6 months in New Japan, see what he can do. It can't be any worse than some of the Bullet Club or House of Torture stuff that we have. He'd certainly get more of a reaction there than here. It was totally fine. It was, you know, I guess part of it too is when you've had Lance Archer there. Lance Archer, you know, ate the fall with Tanahashi in Milwaukee on Wednesday. So you give him a win on the pre-show here, heading into the G1. It was surprising that this match was on the show, but it was totally fine for 6 minutes. The best thing on the pre-show, and honestly, a match that was up there with some of the best stuff from the main show, I thought, was Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland against Yoshinobu Kanemaru.
Yeah.
And the guy that I was most excited to see on this show, in some ways, this was my personal main event, getting to see El Desperado live for the first time. 12 minutes, really good stuff. Hilarious interactions between Kanemaru and Keith Lee, and then a tantalizing preview of what a Swerve Strickland El Desperado singles match could be if we ever get it.
Yeah, I didn't feel alone watching this match, because all I had to do was think about doing this show with you and the people listening to us talk about this match, and I'm thinking the whole time it's going on, this is great. I'm loving Kanemaru. I love, you know, Desperado getting shown off to a completely different audience on a different stage to show off how good he is. Lee and Strickland working great with them. This was just a really, really good preliminary match, and I was getting such a kick out of it. And I'm thinking too, because four matches during the pre-show, by the end of the night, it's like, okay, who's going to remember that match? And then I'm talking about the show throughout the whole week, and because of time constraints, we're not talking about that match. And I'm thinking, you know, I can't wait till we do this show, because finally there are going to be people that go, thank God somebody talked about that match. That was great.
It felt like, honestly, even though it was the third match on a pre-show, it felt like a high-end pay-per-view opener. Like, if that opened this show,
God, yeah,
people would be talking about that being one of the best pay-per-view openers in several years. So we had that. We then had the Gun Club and Max Caster against the LA Dojo. And this was really kind of a nothing match. We had Danhausen show up. That caused Austin and Colton Gunn to run to the back to go after him for whatever reason. I wasn't really paying attention at that point. And then they defeated the remaining members of the team defeated the LA Dojo in 5.5 minutes. We got to see a little bit of Yuya Uemura, but nowhere near enough. Really, my only note on this is that it continued the honestly really strange saga of where the hell is Carl Fredericks? What the hell is going on? What are they doing with him or not doing with him? He was not announced to be part of the G1. He had some tweets about that. He then immediately got pulled from the New Japan Strong taping, where he was going to be teaming with Chris Daniels in the Strong Tag Team title tournament. They even had released promos of the two of them getting ready to team together. He was not put on this pre-show here. He also was not booked subsequently for the New Japan shows taking place next week, or really starting over the weekend at Corican Hall, where Alex Coughlin And Clark Connors are now scheduled to team with the DKC. You would imagine that would have been originally them teaming with Carl Frederick. So who knows? I don't know if it's a deal where, you know, he legitimately ruffled feathers, if they're trying to do a worked shoot angle, which I certainly hope not, because that never works. But in any case, definitely curious to not see Carl Fredericks here.
Yeah, that is that's a little bothersome. Not as bothersome as seeing him in some of these shirts that he wears on
stop it.
On social media. I'm jealous. Because if I could, I would pull that off, but I absolutely can't, especially at 46 years old. But yes, I would like to know this as well too. But you know, as we'll get to later on, you know, it's kind of sucks right now if you're the DKC, since you're kind of the guy that's taking L's in high profile situations, but
yeah, but that's for him. That's progression. I mean, that's the spot that he's at as a young lion. And I mean, it's better taking falls in high profile situations than not being booked for them. So I think he's doing just fine. I think he's a slower developing guy compared to really anyone else that's come through the LA dojo so far. And I don't know how high his ceiling is, but it does seem to be like there's starting to be a little bit of improvement there. I just don't know how much, you know, I don't see him getting to the level really of any of the guys that, you know, you look at that first class of Clark Connors, Alex Coughlin, and Carl Fredericks. They've all in different ways gotten really, really good. And I think a guy like DKC is, you know, he's behind, you know, a Kevin Knight and certainly a Ren Narita and a Yuya Uemura at this point.
You know, I had a point to make that was going to loop back around and finish with Clark Connors, but I'm not sure I know what that is now anymore. But so we'll just continue on through the.
We'll get to Clark in a minute because he had a hell of a performance.
Yeah, he did.
In a situation that not a whole lot of people were really expecting much out of. But we'll get there. The opener of the actual proper pay-per-view, I thought for my money, was the match of the show, that being Eddie Kingston, Wheeler Yuta, and Shota Umino defeating Minoru Suzuki, Chris Jericho, and Sammy Guevara. Just a fantastic match, really all built around making Shota Umino look like the star that New Japan needs him to be. We've talked about, you know, really how star-crossed excursion has been maybe up until the last 6 or 7 months. And how he really at some point needed a breakout performance. You know, the match he had with Jay White at Windy City Riot was good, but it still didn't seem like he had unlocked the potential that he had as a young lion. Here, not only was the match built around him, you know, Chris Jericho in particular gave him so much in this match, but he really stepped up to the plate and fulfilled his potential. And you know, looked great. The crowd reaction to him was tremendous. And he looked like a guy who, you know, while I still don't know if he's going to be a top star, if he's going to be a Tanahashi level guy, he looked like there's more there than we've seen, since he left New Japan with the black tights and started wearing more colorful attire, in the UK.
Yeah, he certainly looks like he could be in the mix, you know, immediately right off the bat, you know, Goto style when he comes back. And who knows? Remember when Goto made his big breakout was Muta on January 4th? Who knows?
Well, he had a few matches, but he had that, and then going on to win the 08 G1 was really the you know, the where he really kind of knocked down the door. I think that comparison to Goto is a really strong one, because you know, some people look at a guy like Goto and think, well, that's a failed career. It's a guy who's won a G1. Won the New Japan Cup. You know, he's always been in the mix, even though he's never been the guy. And companies need that. Not everybody's going to be a Tanahashi or Okada. So if Umino, quote unquote, only becomes a Goto, and let's say, you know, Uemura is the guy who, you know, becomes the Tanahashi or the Okada out of that group, not a bad thing.
No, timing is going to matter, of course, because obviously with Goto, people talk about him being failed because he lost IWGP title matches at a time where they were expanding him out more and more, and they weren't going to trade the title, but you had to have more title defenses. He was a victim of that. When Umino comes in, what's the landscape going to be when he finally, what's it like with Bullet Club? What's it like with this? What's it like with that as he navigates
his way
in?
What's it like with Tanahashi? Because at some points, we're already seeing it to where he's not always in the top of the mix. But at some point, and God knows when he continues to draw out these incredible performances. But at some point, the injuries and age are going to take the toll to where they're going to need someone to be in that, you know, upper mid card slash main event level. And, you know, he might be the guy if the timing is right to fill that role.
And I like the thought of Umino teaming with Tanahashi over there over time, because that's the person that, to me, that you're going to learn the most from, that you can glean the most from just by standing there next to him, watching him do his thing. I think that would be a great idea. He's going to get a big taste of American style and what Muda got and more, because he's a made guy here. Moxley, everything that's gone with him, the response that he got, taking the fireball, his performance in this match, Umino's a made man here in the same way, in a different type of way, but kind of in the same way in the fans' eyes that I think Wheeler Yuta, as far as a junior heavyweight imported threat, I think Japanese fans seem to, again, it's really difficult to not look at what Wheeler Yuta's done in the best of the Super Juniors and see his performance in this match, see how he gels with the Blackpool Combat Club and how he plays next to them, and not think he's going to have a very fruitful career in Japan.
Yeah, absolutely. And not just in Japan. I mean, in AEW, in his home promotion, like, it's hard to think of a more effective recent example of using a match and a guy losing in a match or in a series of matches, but doing so in such a valiant way, for lack of a better word, a guy getting over and his stock being raised so much as Yuta was in those matches with Jon Moxley, and then, you know, being slapped by Regal and joining the Blackpool Combat Club. That guy is so over, and it's not just a one city thing or a region thing. It's everywhere. Really, the other story and the biggest story out of this match, I'm not sure how it came across on TV. I have not watched the broadcast yet, but in the building, this continues to be the case wherever they go. Eddie Kingston is the most popular guy in that company. I don't care how many guys they bring in from the outside, how many bigger stars, quote unquote, there is no one in AEW that the fans have anywhere near the emotional connection with that they do to Eddie Kingston. I'm not going to necessarily say that all that means he's got to have the world title, because that doesn't necessarily need to be the case. In some ways, it's a benefit to have a guy that over, and you can have him win stuff. He can win big matches. He can win big feuds. But to always sort of hold that out there that he hasn't won the world title, if you ever need to pull the trigger, particularly when you're in a situation, let's say you get down again like they are right now, where you have a ton of top guys hurt, then you can pull that ace in the hole out and have Eddie Kingston win the title. But man, he is just, it's something to be in a big arena when people are dying to see that guy get in the ring.
Sounds familiar. Sounds like, I don't know, some sort of American dream. You know, basically kind of what you described there.
100%. It's funny because you couldn't have a guy who looks more different or talks more differently from Dusty Rhodes than Eddie Kingston, but it is 100% that vibe. He is a Dusty Rhodes type of character to this audience. He is, you know, AEW's answer to Tommy Dreamer, whatever you want to say. And I'm not talking about, you know, Tommy Dreamer that was a jobber in WWE, but Tommy Dreamer and the way the ECW fans connected with him, the way the crowd did. You know, I was there at ECW shows and I experienced that. And, you know, Eddie Kingston, you know, to a bigger level because it's bigger arenas, but it's a similar deal. and yeah, I mean, there's so many directions they can go with him. And pretty much every single time it works, that's obviously it's a credit to him. It was wild here in this match that while Jericho is the feud, and that's certainly something people are hyped for, everyone in this building, what they wanted more than anything was Eddie Kingston and Minoru Suzuki to go at it.
And they got it. Yeah. They got it. And, you know, let's not gloss over Chris Jericho here, who is obviously a terrible, horrible person whose father did at least play for a quality hockey team. But
let the record show that was Mike Sempervivi that said that. I don't want to somehow get double blocked on Twitter. I've already been blocked for like 4 years for criticizing, or however long it's been, for criticizing his performance against Okada years ago. But yeah, he knocked it out of the park here. I thought this was one of his most effective performances, one of his most effective matches, as we said, particularly with Shota Umino, going back to slapping Shota Umino in the face when Shota was a young lion in front of his dad. Just a great job by Jericho in this match.
Great work. Three different kind of veterans in there putting on great work. You know, Eddie Kingston being the junior of those guys, but Minoru Suzuki and Chris Jericho. With Minoru Suzuki, it's so easy because just go be Minoru Suzuki. And we'll get to exactly. Sting later on as well, too, who has actually added a new wrinkle, obviously. But, like, he could just walk out there and be Sting. And the same thing when it comes to Minoru Suzuki. And, look, everybody got what they wanted, not the least of which was Eddie Kingston, who gets to go out there and bang away with Minoru Suzuki on a big pay-per-view.
Yes, 100%. Great way to start the show. Like I said, for me, the match of the show, just awesome stuff. We then had the three-way tag match for both the IWGP Heavyweight Tag Team titles and the Ring of Honor World Tag Team title. I honestly really don't have a whole lot to say about this match. I guess watching it live, it seemed like the Dax Harwood injury was legit because it was not built to at all. It was not off of a move. He just went to the back and then came back out 10 or 15 minutes later. I know they got the big pop from him coming back, but I honestly thought it hurt the match and it hurt the overall reaction to when they finally got the pin. What also hurt it was Paul Turner counting a 3.9 count for Rocky Romero on a roll up that definitely took the wind out of the crowd's sails, thinking that Roppongi Vice had won instead of what everyone wanted, which was FTR winning. It was fine. I didn't think it was anything great, though. I know some people said it was just a hell of a match. To me, it was good, but that was about it.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. It was super solid. I think too much time, and I think it was a smart move with all the injuries that have taken place and so many people going, all right, well, what could happen next? To do that, I thought it was a creative thing to do. Now, I think too much time elapsed from the time he got back until the finish.
Yeah, you know, well, too much time elapsed from the time he got back to the finish, and it just, to me, again, I don't know if they're just trying to make it seem realistic that he actually got hurt, but that stretch from when he went out to when he came back, it just, in a lot of ways, to me, it just felt like killing time, which is never good. But yeah, he came back, and then kind of the match just continued.
Yeah, with him doing, you know, offense that you wouldn't necessarily pull off if you were that banged up and had a dislocated shoulder, but it doesn't matter. End of the day, Romero and Beretta were there to do what they were supposed to do. And I know a lot of people were like, well, you know, they were, you know, everybody knew they were going to take the fall. They had been built up because some people had asked me that don't follow New Japan regularly, aren't they junior heavyweights? Yeah, but they on New Japan, even though they haven't beaten you over the head with it, they have been mentioning that they are in the heavyweight ranks, that they were looking at going after the IWGP titles now for quite some time, which did lead into this. And FTR, Great O'Cobb. You know, they should be called the Great O'Cobb.
The
right
Great
now.
O'Cobb. That's a tremendous tag team name.
You know, to see the Great O'Cobb and FTR battle again in Japan, I think is going to be great. He gives FTR a chance to go to Japan and work.
Well, that's what I'm most excited about out of all of this. This match was good, but I'm really excited to see them in Japan, see particularly if we ever get to a point where crowd restrictions are gone, and we'll touch on that a little bit later before the show ends. But yeah, I want to see what they can do in that environment for sure. Hyped to see them with the tag belts in Japan.
And it's a microcosm of the rest of the show, if I'm using that term, you know, correctly, with FTR of this is step one. And that's the thing about this show is the whole thing was one big step one of getting everybody to work with each other and all that sort of, you know, rigmarole in all this time. This is just step one. And that's the same thing for FTR and for a lot of these guys, too, because, again, we are so early in the game. We haven't seen anybody except for the junior heavyweights go over there. Lance Archer doesn't count. We will see how this relationship will develop and exactly where FTR is going to fall here, too, because, again, they seem to have more options as far as being able to have people to work with than we've seen so far. That's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, I'm very much looking forward to seeing what the next few months, what the rest of the year brings for them, particularly in going to Japan. The next match, the AEW All-Atlantic Championship four-way, the first of two four-way singles championship matches on the show. Malakai Black, Pac, Miro, and Clark Connors, who replaced Tomohiro Ishii. Ishii defeated Clark Connors in a great match at Corken Hall to get the spot in this four-way, but came down with a knee injury. Clark Connors, as the finalist in that mini tournament, was named as the replacement. Some people were very disappointed, but I can't imagine they would have been disappointed by the end of this match, because Clark Connors put in, as I said earlier, a hell of a performance. I thought this was a really clever, really just smart match as far as how it was put together. Clark Connors constantly going at Miro and just constantly getting thrown around by Miro and just getting shut down at every corner until he finally hit the spear on the floor through the table. Had some great moments where it looked like he might actually win the belt before that ended up not happening. Pac hitting the Black Arrow, hitting the getting the Brutalizer locked in, winning the title here. Really, I thought kind of the only any of these guys would be a good champion, but with how hard they pushed on commentary on AEW about AEW being the top wrestling company in the UK, and they said that so many times, it seemed very clear that this was a belt that was made for Pac.
Been there since day one, and it does make complete sense that he has this title, as you mentioned with Clark Connors, as soon as he put Miro through the table on the floor. I mean, everybody, the guy no one thought had any chance of winning was baiting fans into believing, well, maybe, meh. And of course, that obviously went out of everybody's minds quickly, and Pac ultimately gets the victory here. But I thought this was just, it just shows great basics. It shows very simple storytelling, even in a four-way match, when it came to Connors. And it shows you where that fiery babyface comeback, I mean, this guy's probably going to be a heel, maybe a more effective heel. Who knows what his career is going to
bring.
Oh,
I don't know about that. I think he's a very effective babyface. I do think what this match showed and what both the Ishii and Homa matches from last week in New Japan showed is that while he was in the best of the Super Junior tournament, and yes, he's short, this is a power wrestler that is much better suited to wrestling heavyweights than junior heavyweights.
I wholeheartedly agree there. Absolutely. And, it was like El Phantasma in a little bit of a different way. But, yeah, you kind of look at him the same way and you go, yeah, he's, again, because I think he comes across, and we'll see him in bigger stages as he moves up too. But what did Randy Savage and Tully Blanchard and Jushin Liger and guys like that have going for them? You forgot their size because their persona was so big. They felt bigger in the ring, and I think he's got the potential for that, just judging off of the little bit we've seen so far and certainly what we saw in that match.
Well, think of sort of his size contemporaries as well, and granted, he might even be a little bit shorter than them, and I'm not saying he's going to be as great as any of those guys turned out to be, but think of, an Eddie Guerrero, a Dean Malenko, a Chris Benoit, those sorts of guys where, as their careers went along, that you didn't think about them being short because they wrestled bigger than they were and they never looked out of place against heavyweights. That, that seems to be slowly happening with Clark Connors as well. So good stuff here. Great performance from Clark Connors in a situation that, 48, 72 hours before the show, he could not possibly have imagined that he would be in. So good to see him there pull that off. We then had El Phantasmo and the Young Bucks with Hikuleo in their corner against Darby Allin, Sting, and Shingo Takagi. And what I talked earlier about a guy that maybe the only guy in the show that I was a little bit disappointed in the reactions to, Shingo Takagi is the guy that I was referencing. The crowd got into him by the end. They were into him as he was hitting his big moves, as he got the win, pinning El Phantasmo, but he did not get much of a reaction at all when he was introduced. And I think part of that goes back to what I said earlier. These are fans who were very familiar with a lot of the top New Japan guys, even some of the guys like a Goto and a Yoshihashi who aren't considered top guys, but they've been casual at best watchers of New Japan over the past couple of years. And those past couple of years have been where Shingo Takagi, you know, has become a main event star, you know, a guy who, because of, you know, injuries and circumstances, you know, was thrust into the IWGP World Heavyweight title scene. And, you know, talk about hitting grand slams, he definitely did. But it's a guy who, you know, came to prominence in New Japan after his Dragon Gate years at a time where less eyes than usual were watching the company.
For me, this match 100% is about Sting. And that's really absolutely all I can talk about. Bucks and Phantasmo are perfect together as far as the types of trollish heels that they are. It's perfect. Phantasmo as a heavyweight is no question, again, where his career goes. But as far as having the look, being able to wrestle, standing in there, no problem at all. Darby Allin is the most realistic person in pro wrestling because everything he does, I believe, is either going to kill him or his opponent, and it is amazing to watch this guy go out there. Look, it was like Dynamite Kid. A lot of people talk about Dynamite Kid and Tiger Mask. One of the things about, and again, wrestling is a different business now, so we have longer setup times and fans accept those. But with Darby, you don't get that because everything is fired out of a cannon, and it stands out. And he scares me, but he's amazing. Who also scares me and who also is amazing is, of course, Sting, a guy I've been watching on my television since 1985 or 86, whenever he showed up in Mid-South.
Well, a guy who, and from my perspective, sitting there in the United Center, it's a guy who I had watched in that very building as a 16-year-old kid 25 years ago in the United Center. And then here he was showing up in the rafters and then diving off the stage onto the Bucks and Phantasma and Hikuleo. That reaction when he no-sold the double superkick was one of the most amazing live moments for me of 30 years of going to pro wrestling. Everyone losing their minds, going to their feet, cheering. Apparently, Jeremy and I were shown on the broadcast and on the big screen, losing our minds when that happened. It was something else, and we've talked about it before. There are few things in wrestling that make me happier right now than Sting getting to write the story of the end of his career in a way that he was not going to be allowed to do in the WWE, and it warms my heart as a kid who grew up on Sting.
I'll be honest. I love Sting so much. It doesn't bother me. If you want to hang like 5 wires to him to make sure that he doesn't fall, because there was the one thing after that dive, he bounced off everybody and then he bounced onto the ramp. And granted, you know, it was a short distance, but it was a long distance before he hit those other people.
Yeah, he didn't just ride them down to the floor. He hit them and then he sort of bounced off left side of his body, hitting the stage area. It was wild.
Yeah, and look, if this is what he loves to do, great. I'm all for it. I just keep him safe. If he just stands there in the middle of the ring though, and everybody bounces off of him, like, you know, taking Dusty Rhodes' bionic elbow,
a Steven Seagal movie or something.
Yeah, then, you know, I would be fine with that too, because he's Sting and he's awesome. And you mentioned about Shingo, people took a little bit more time to kind of warm into him, but it doesn't matter. This whole thing was about Sting. The spot where the titty twister spot where that he forgot on the second one and he goes back in, only Sting could do that. Oh, you got to be a star to just go, hey, come here. Yeah. And nobody cares.
Phantasmo,
it was awesome. In fact,
great
it made it job better
of improvising there as well.
Yes.
To make that not look as bad as it would have looked otherwise.
Oh, I thought it was great. Because it was Sting, it ended up being great. And you know, Phantasmo taking the fall to Shingo, I thought, you know, that flies under the radar. But I thought, again, for the Japanese portion of the proceedings, we probably will see those two match off again because they're perfect for each other. But Shingo, being the higher person on the scale, welcome into the heavyweight ranks with this El Fantasmo. So I thought the whole that whole thing worked perfectly. The Young Bucks got to, you know, live their wrestling fantasies out by wrestling Sting. Darby is Darby, so big win.
Yeah, absolutely. Just great fun. Every Sting match in AEW is great fun. And this, with the added element of having Shingo in there, was great. Just bummed, like you said earlier, that Hiromu Takahashi couldn't be a part of it. Just seeing Hiromu and Sting in the same ring would have it would have been great, but we did not get that. After that, what was next up? What did we have next?
We had the Fireball, and then it was Thunder Rosa and Toni Storm.
Yes, Thunder Rosa and Toni Storm. This was good. It felt like it was on the road to being more than just good, and then it just kind of ended. The finish wasn't. I don't know. I don't think anyone in the crowd expected that to be the finish. That like spinning suplex, Dustin Rhodes type of finisher. I'm very much looking forward to seeing more of Toni Storm going after the belt. I don't really know where they go from here with Thunder Rosa as champion. Really, the person who seems like she should be getting one of the two women's titles is Chris Statlander, and she's tied up with Jade Cargill in the TBS title. So, not quite sure where they're going next with Thunder Rosa. But it was good, but it really didn't reach anything more than that, which is a little bit disappointing given both people involved. But I think, it just the finish was what it was.
The Rosa, it's felt like, you were on a ride with her until like the beginning of this year. And I don't know what it's been where it seems like, I don't know if she's been hurt because there's been talk about that. And I know she had some lingering injuries that she talked about, but how bad they were and her booking and the stories and angles she's been involved with. It's like, there's part of me that I just want her to lose the title. Let's rebuild this thing because the Dustin story, why they're trying to tie her so much in with him, I don't think has been made crystal clear. So it's like, I almost would rather her go back to the fiery chase and let's get it back again, because I don't think it's working right now. And Toni Storm, Thunder Rose is at least, as of right now, she's going to Tokyo Joshi Pro. So I can see that.
So
belt.
That was part of the other intrigue for this as well, is that you had Toni Storm, who had been for so long associated with Stardom and has openly said she wants to go back there. And then you have Thunder Rosa, who, formerly, had held a championship in Tokyo Joshi Pro, and she's going back on the 9th to wrestle Miyu Yamashita.
So I'm interested to see exactly now what happens with that title, if she goes over there with it or what exactly is going to happen. But yeah, again, a story for a different day and a different show, but they need some shaking up to that division.
The easiest way to describe it is it's hard to book babyface champions, particularly after the coming off of a long chase. A lot of times it doesn't work, and I think you can put this in the column of one of those things that just
especially
so far
when you feed her,
hasn't worked.
Especially when you feed her Nyla Rose and Vicky, and then it was Marina Shafir, and there have been things that just I'm surprised they were doing it, and then they didn't work in execution, and it's like, well, so I don't know. But one again, Britt Baker, there are other people there that can spice things up and maybe get things moving, although, again, Britt Baker and Adam Cole as heels, just, I don't know, whatever. But doesn't matter. What matters is Will Ospreay and Orange Cassidy. Look, I am not going to sit here. I've always been an Orange Cassidy supporter. At times I have banged my head against the wall with Will Ospreay, but the fact of the matter is he is a supremely talented athlete who is a damn good professional wrestler who is on the rise. Personality, promos aside, in the ring, he is something else. I would have loved to see him face somebody else, but Orange Cassidy is that person. Orange Cassidy and Will Ospreay, whether anybody likes it or not, Will Ospreay is the perfect person for a guy like Orange Cassidy to face. And I thought it was, I don't want to say a perfect match, but if you are an Orange Cassidy fan, if you're a fan of this type of deal, it was really fun. It was everything that you wanted it to be and probably more. It was awesome. And if you're not a fan of this type of match or Orange Cassidy, then you should have just skipped it because I don't want to hear you bitch and moan about it. It was as simple as going to do something else while this was taking place. But if you sat there and watched it, you see how great Ospreay is and you see how fun Orange Cassidy is and how the fans take to him.
Yeah, I'm not an Orange Cassidy guy. Like I we talked about before on the podcast, like I would never say he's not good at what he does. And I see, you know, why people get into it, but it's just, it's not my cup of tea.
Yeah. I never would have booked him for this match. You know, if he was the replacement for, well, it's like, I would never would have booked him as the replacement for Andrade.
No.
My mind would not have gone, well, let's do Orange. And I understand why other people's do, but it would not have been mine.
I could have, yeah, there were dozens of guys that I could have thought of that I would have preferred to see in this match over Orange Cassidy. You know, if you're talking about dream matches that you can book with Will Ospreay and AEW. But this was awesome. It was super entertaining. It was one of those where you talked about earlier with a different match where, like, the finish was obvious. You talked about that with Roppongi Vice. Like, on almost every match on this show, it was extremely easy to pick who would win. You know, and that's one of the pitfalls, if you can call it that, of doing these interpromotional shows is that you've got to balance out the wins and losses. You've got the politics. And so a lot of times it's, you know, it's a guy that's a name that's got some credibility, but that isn't too big of a deal that you can afford to sacrifice so that the other side gets a win to balance out you getting the win that you want. And that's what Orange Cassidy was here. But I mean, to their credit, like, there were near falls that, even though I'm sure going into this match, nobody thought Orange Cassidy was going to leave the United Center as the IWGP U.S. Heavyweight Champion. The near fall, I believe it was on the beach break spot, was absolutely insane. Everyone bought it. They had people going. We were going crazy in our seats watching this as well. I can't imagine anyone getting a better match out of Orange Cassidy and out of that character in terms of being in a serious championship match. I can't imagine anyone getting more out of Orange Cassidy than Will Ospreay did here. And Cassidy, to his credit, put in, you know, a great performance as well. So, yeah, good stuff. Would not have been my choice for a U.S. title match on the show, but this was awesome. This was, to me, right up there with the pay-per-view opener, the six-man tag, and the main event as the matches of the show.
Yeah, kind of leading into this too, it's I cannot help but look at things from a New Japan booking perspective too, and I think, okay, well, Will Ospreay and Orange, with how you're building United Empire and everything, it's like, okay, how is this all gonna, you know, again, just you start overthinking things, and then by the end of the match, it's like, well, how long before Orange is in New Japan working Yano for the KOPW title and doing this or doing that? Because I'm thinking, after this is over, with the way things have changed, with how things are accepted, it's not like you could take Orange Cassidy, I think, and go, okay, put him in the main event against Naito or Okada, wherever. But you could certainly introduce him and get him to a certain level there where he is a fun distraction, I think, or a person that New Japan fans may want to see work. I'm interested to see, because again, watching him on the indies and watching, I knew he is what he is and how polarizing he is. And now we've seen it on the AEW level nationally, that a lot of merchandise, he gets ratings, he gets attention. Again, would it work for a long-term push on top? Probably not, no. But it'll be interesting to see if they can pull this off in Japan, or he's able to pull this off in Japan. Seems far better fit for DDT, but nothing would surprise me anymore.
Yeah, no, I fully expect him to go over to New Japan proper and get over in a big way with the audience. He's sort of, you know, again, if the crowd likes Yano, and we know they do, they're going to love Orange Cassidy. So yeah, I fully expect that. We then had a completely different match in terms of characters than something you get with Orange Cassidy. that being Claudio Castagnoli as the replacement for Bryan Danielson, really the only guy that the replacement could have been when you listen back to Bryan Danielson's promos and how much they hyped this up. Wrestling Zack Sabre Jr. Thought this was really good, particularly given the amount of time that Claudio Castagnoli has been off, the type of matches he was doing when he was wrestling in WWE, and how different the WWE style is from wrestling Zack Sabre Jr. It also is a match that, as good as it was, I would imagine 6 months from now, when Claudio is wrestling regularly, that this would have a chance to be even better. He did seem to be a little bit winded as the match got later on. It was also kind of strange from a booking standpoint in that clearly Bryan Danielson was going to win this match. And so for all the booking and sort of the politics of who beats who throughout the rest of the show, for that to not get thrown completely out of whack, Claudio Castagnoli had to beat Zack Sabre Jr. here as well. Whereas if this was just a one-off match booked from the beginning, I don't know that New Japan would have been as okay with ZSJ losing to Claudio here. But great to see Claudio back. Great to see the reaction to him. Great to see him in this environment. I always say, the nicest guy I've ever met in professional wrestling, opened his house to me and my friends when we drove in 2005 on the way to New York City. We stayed overnight at his place in Pennsylvania. Just the nicest dude. Stayed up till 3 in the morning watching wrestling tapes with him. Super cool. Did not look down on us as wrestling fans. Hung out with us the following day as he was waiting for the show to start in New York City. A great dude. Want all the good things for him, and very much excited to see him not only in AEW, but hoping we see him from time to time in New Japan as well.
Were you so happy that you would have hugged him at a press conference? There was nobody.
I would have. And that whole controversy about Tony Khan hugging guys.
Wait, what is it? There's a controversy?
Well, you've not seen people complaining and saying how pathetic it is, and that he shouldn't be doing that.
Oh,
shut the hell up.
I'm far from
a guy who says that everything Tony Khan does with AEW is perfect. But my God, if you have a problem with a guy hugging another guy, and a promoter being excited to have a wrestler that he's always enjoyed watching, having him on his roster, I don't know what to tell you, but the problem is with you and not the guy giving the hug.
Some people are just, they're wired, they're emotional, and I get it. Now, if he was Shad Khan, I don't know, because he's the owner. That's a little bit different. But remember, Tony Khan is a promoter, and I think people forget about this when he goes, we're going to have this huge announcement, it's the biggest thing ever in AEW. He's a promoter. He's Don King, he's Bob Arum, he's Vince McMahon.
Dana White.
He's Dana White. He's all these guys. That's what makes them successful. That's what makes them who they are and all that. So it's silly. I think, you know, would I do it? No. But you know what? Every once in a while, God damn it, you got to have a hug. You got to have a cry. You got to be, if this is not working all your emotions, if it's not working all your senses, have you really gone all out? And, you know, that's the one thing about these AEW shows. I was there after the Baltimore show, for anything you can say about it, you know, nobody is half-assing it. Everybody is giving everything that they have, and nobody else is doing that more than Tony Khan, whether you like him or not. And Claudio coming in to work this match, getting that done and signed, thank God. I didn't think it could be anybody else. I didn't think it would be anybody else, and thankfully it's not. Maybe this leads to the first time Zack Sabre Jr. and Bryan Danielson meet. Zack Sabre Jr. beats him. And because of Zack losing to Claudio, and I cannot wait for the Danielson Sabre match to happen. At some point it's going to happen. I know there were people that were, I don't know what else you can say. I mean, they popped people right away with the neutralizer spot that Sabre kicked out of to do that right off the bat. People were going bananas. And then, again, the match was really good. Sabre loses nothing. Anybody that was talking about before the match, oh, God, do you really want to have Sabre lose when the match is Danielson? Who cares? Who cares? Claudio had to win because of what he was going into with the Blackpool Combat Club at Blood and Guts. With Sabre, all his excuses right there. I didn't know who it was going to be. And then you give me one of the greatest guys in the world, Danielson. You know, you had all the advantage here, and I still stood in there. And if I got him a second time, I'd beat him the same way I'm going to beat you the first time. To me, all that, some of that talk and some of the nervousness over Sabre losing, I thought was unfounded. I thought it would have hurt Claudio far more because of what he had to go into. As Adam takes the microphone off mute.
No, I was not on mute. You just stopped talking like in the middle of your sentence.
That was a period I put at the end of it, yeah.
I was waiting to see what was happening there, if we had an audio nightmare of sorts. But no, this was it again, like I said, it makes sense given the context of kind of if you had Zack Sabre Jr. win, you really would have had to rebook the entire show to make everything else work in terms of the politics of everything. So it's fine. The kayfabe sort of excuse from Zack Sabre Jr. as far as everything you just said is there in place. And very much looking forward to ZSJ versus Danielson and somewhere down the line, ZSJ versus Claudio, you know, with Claudio being even more in ring shape than he already is. So good stuff there. That then takes us to maybe, as I said earlier, the only disappointment of the night, that being the IWGP World Heavyweight Title 4-Way match. Jay White, Kazuchika Okada, Adam Cole, and Adam Page. The story of this match in arena was just Okada being so over. He came across as one of, if not the biggest star on this show. And it really did take the wind out of the sails of the crowd when he did not win this match, because everyone not only wanted him to win this match, but you could tell everyone in the crowd for the most part was convinced that this was going to be the re-coronation of Okada. They thought for sure he was going to win, particularly when he was in there with Adam Cole. Everyone figured, okay, that's it. He's going to hit Cole with the Rainmaker. He's going to get the win. You know, they were very much into the Okada and Hangman Page standoffs. You know, the finish certainly came off flat, mostly because of Adam Cole's injury, kind of necessitating it to end maybe a little bit earlier, a little bit more differently than it would have. But even before that, like this, you know, it's, I think people would have preferred to see Okada in a single. I get all the reasons why. You know, we talked about with Roppongi Vice, you know, them being there basically to launder the finish through them. Same thing here with Adam Cole. The finish was always going to be someone beating Adam Cole. It was just going to be, was Jay White going to get the pin on him, or was Okada going to get the pin? And the idea here was Jay White getting the pin. It is interesting, though, when you look at this show and you look at top New Japan stars that got wins, really the only top star in the company that got a significant win on this show was Jay White. I mean, you had Shingo winning, but he pinned a fellow New Japan guy in El Fantasmo. Really the only big New Japan win over an AEW star was Jay White pinning Adam Cole. So if you wondered where Jay White stood in the pecking order of New Japan, as if you should wonder at this point, I think this would have answered all questions. He's the guy along with Okada right now.
Well, and if you're AEW, he's the perfect, you know, English speaker, perfect fit with the top members of your company. And if you're New Japan, obviously, you know, in the English speaking world, we saw this, you know, with Jay White, you know, it works out perfectly. As the days have gone by since this match, the more I think this was just a throwaway IWGP title match that featured...
It really was. Maybe more than any in the history of the championship, at least in recent times. It just... Yeah, whatever story they're going to tell with Jay White as champion, this is just... it's a very, very small part of that. I mean, I guess, you know, in the U.S., we're probably going to have some sort of Bullet Club versus the Super Elite deal. But yeah, this just, it's weird. This almost felt, and this is probably overly strong, but this almost felt like a Raw main event more than something you would see on a pay-per-view, just in terms of the importance that it's going to have going forward.
I you're exactly right. Because just like a Raw main event, you would have those four big names, four really talented people. you know, but at the end of the night, you know, whatever would happen would happen. And it's like, okay, well, let's move on to what comes next. And Okada being in there, I'm glad he was able to make it. You know, it meant something to have him on the show. It did. It meant something to those live fans that are there. It means something on paper in history when you look at the lineup and you go, oh, Okada was on that show. But the match itself, because of the environment, I don't know what's wrong with Adam Cole. I don't know what was wrong at the end of that match with the concussion or whatever took place there. He seems to have... He's got nagging shoulder injuries. I wonder how bad they actually are and how bad he is physically and how much rest he's needed. But he has not been the same Adam Cole. He hasn't had that same magic as he has, you know, in the past. Adam Page rises far above, in my opinion, how they book him and some of the storylines and things that he has given, including leading into this match. I mean... The fans take to him. When he's in the ring, he just surpasses all of that. And I think the booking and I think the whole deal is going to catch up. And at some point, Hangman Page is going to be a much bigger star than he is right now. Jay White is a big star, and I think he's one of the best things in New Japan. Obviously, Okada is Okada. So, as you mentioned... Long story short, this was very Raw-like in that, okay, well, let's see what happens next week with these guys. But now that this is over with, it was just a blip in the atmosphere.
Yeah, a very forgettable match. I think it's a match that really, when you look back on this show, I think 2-3 years from now, people will be scratching their heads and say, what was the IWGP title match on this show? I'm sure there was one, but they won't really remember it. Like you said, with Hangman Page, I think that, honestly, he might be AEW's biggest success story, at least for me, in that he's a guy who I really had no interest in seeing. To me, he was just a guy. Like, I think back to him challenging Jericho for the first AEW World Championship, you know, to become the first champion, and how he just really felt like an afterthought and felt like he didn't belong. And for him to be at the point where he's at now, you know, you'd hope that the next time he's the champion, you know, he's not only the champion, but he really is, from a storyline standpoint, the focus of the company week in and week out. So that then leads into the interim AEW World Championship match, a match that would have been CM Punk versus Hiroshi Tanahashi. Instead, through a long and winding road, we ended up with finally getting Hiroshi Tanahashi versus Jon Moxley. Very, very good match. And the thing that stood out to me more than anything, to me, it's the takeaway from this entire show, is just that I came away more convinced than ever, as if I needed any more convincing, that Hiroshi Tanahashi is the best wrestler of my generation. He's the best wrestler of the past 35 years. When you just factor everything in and you look at this match, Jon Moxley, a guy who... Week in and week out, you know, we talked about Eddie Kingston. Moxley's another one that is, you know, one of the most over, one of the most consistently beloved characters in AEW. That moment where Moxley has Tanahashi down and out and the United Center starts chanting, "Go Ace," and is cheering for Hiroshi Tanahashi over Jon Moxley to somehow come back, get the win, and become the interim AEW champion. That's on my very short list of best live wrestling moments. And just, you know, I just hope that as people, you know, if you're someone who watches wrestling and you care about wrestling, you're in that building, I hope people really just, you know, stopped and took a moment to really take in how lucky we were to get to see at this age and at this, you know, the physical condition that Tanahashi is in, to get to see him in a main event of a major show like this yet again, putting in this type of performance. You know, it can't last much longer, but you don't ever want it to end. That's kind of where I'm at every time I see Tanahashi in one of these situations.
Now, he is an all-timer.
Oh my God. Yeah, he's an all-timer, and the performance he put in here and the reaction he got was an all-timer, particularly when you think about how ridiculous the go-home sell was for this show, where they had not brought this up at all. And then in the last few minutes on Dynamite, when Tanahashi and Moxley were teaming, You had Tony Schiavone and William Regal, who I both love, but they were both screaming about how Jon Moxley has to win this match because it will be such a disaster for AEW if Hiroshi Tanahashi becomes the interim AEW world champion. And then you flash to this match and you've got 16,000 people in the United Center, most of them cheering for Hiroshi Tanahashi over Jon Moxley to become the champion. It just made that that go-home sell from Dynamite even more ridiculous and just weird.
Did anyone, for all of the history that fans have with Jim Ross's history with New Japan, no one put over Mox or Okada, and certainly no one put over Tanahashi more than Jim Ross.
Yeah.
In the lead up to this thing, and the just by not even overselling it, by just basically like, man, this is one of the best wrestlers I have ever seen.
Yeah, and Jim Ross saying that, knowing his history and just knowing how long he's been around, like that's all the that's all he needs to say. No more hyperbole is needed. When he says this guy is one of the three best wrestlers I've ever seen, he's the equivalent of Bret Hart. Like, you don't need to say anything else. And for all the criticisms, rightly so at this point, about Jim Ross on commentary, I thought, and I agree, I thought he was very effective at trying to get the top New Japan stars over in the lead up to this, when outside of the countdown show, which aired after Rampage last Friday, AEW really didn't make any other effort beyond Jim Ross to really give any context to a lot of these guys.
No, they really dropped the ball that way. And there are a lot of people, well, you know, and again, look, like I said at the beginning of the show, I think a lot of people that if you knew, you knew. And if you just weren't naturally attracted to this show or the people involved in it, you just weren't going to be. But now that it has happened, now that people are a little more familiar with some of these guys and these names, and these, they're putting names to faces and things like that, as we move forward, I think you know what you need to do. And one of those things is that highlight reel showing off of how great this guy has been against a number of opponents people would know, you know, for all of these years. And he's still, even though sometimes he's a little stiff, even though it looks like sometimes that...
When you say stiff, you don't mean hitting guys hard. No. You mean his joints have trouble moving.
Well, exactly. A little mechanic, you're waiting, you're hoping somebody will jump up, and instead of water, they have a little bit of oil, and they kind of just like squeeze it in, and they get like, you
grease
know,
some up WD. Those knees a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. And in the shoulders and everything. And there are times, every once in a while, where that happens, but in a big match like this, he's still the best, and he's another one of those guys that, much like a Sting and others, he doesn't even have to do the stuff that he's doing. If he did even less and just posed, people would still love it because he's Tanahashi. But Moxley was a good opponent for him. I still maintain how good of an opponent he was for him, because like a Jericho, like some other Americans, where you can throw a lot more punches and kicks and use some plunder and do some other stuff that makes it a little bit easier on Tanahashi when it's time to pull off that high fly flow, or it's time to pull off whatever it is he's going to do. He's actually got an extra little spring to him. Or at least I'd like to envision that for the shape and the age that he's in right now with all of the miles on him. So I think these types of matches are going to do a lot to extend his career. And the more we see him mixing it up with Americans, again, I like it, because we're at this point with Tanahashi where I'm down with anything, but dream matches and him trying to get somebody up to his level, that's what I'm all about with this guy at this point. There's nothing else you can give me. Okada's the guy right now with Tanahashi. I mean, whatever it's going to be, I'll take it.
Oh, yeah. No, this is all, we're in bonus time with him. We're getting more than I think anyone could have reasonably expected at this point. Given the shape of his knees in particular, it's amazing to watch him live and see the connection that he has both with people who know him as a wrestler and how he's able to project and draw people in that, you know, probably came to the building not expecting to be cheering for him over Jon Moxley. And, you know, sort of as we wrap up talking about this show, to me, one of the main takeaways from this was just seeing the New Japan guys getting a chance to wrestle in front of a huge, large, loud, vocal crowd and how much it fired all those guys up, you know, from Yoshihashi at the beginning all the way through to Hiroshi Tanahashi at the end. There is nobody, nobody that deserved and probably got more out of this more than Hiroshi Tanahashi. You think back to a couple months back, that scene where there's a kid, you know, that wants to high five him and he can't go over there because the restrictions don't allow it. And it just breaks his heart. And he's crying backstage because he can't have that moment. He was soaking everything in, even after the angle, you know, where he got beat down and then just had to lay there for 5 minutes as we had the whole thing setting up, blood and guts. Tanahashi then, you know, he goes around the ring. He's high-fiving fans. You know, Tony Khan is bringing out negative one. As that's going on, Tanahashi is walking next to the ramp, and he's hugging fans. He's, you know, almost literally lifting children up into his arms. Like, he just it felt like a night that he really needed, and I'm just so happy on so many levels that he had it, that we were able to be there. And like we said to start this off, I don't know that this is on the short list of greatest pay-per-views of all time, but it was a great pay-per-view, and I'm so happy that I was able to be there for it. And, you know, kudos to both AEW and New Japan for, you know, taking what could have been a really underwhelming show, given all the injuries, all the changes, literally right up until the day before, rolling with the punches and putting out a show that was not only memorable in and of itself, but is going to serve as a template for both the relationship and future Forbidden Door shows, I would imagine, both in the U.S. and in Japan in the coming years. Great, great stuff all around.
I can't say it any better than that, so I'll just say I can't wait till he comes in his cockroach mask to work a GCW
yes.
weekend.
He can have another life towards the end of his career, reprising that role from the movie. I'll still never forget just the complete and utter wackiness of that match at Korakuen when the movie came out, where everybody was doing their different gimmicks, including Togi Makabe and Okada in that match as well. Just hilarious stuff.
Oh, my. So, yeah, you know, it's probably the final word on Forbidden Door for everybody. It should be. Now that you've listened to this, you shall hear no other words on Forbidden Door. But there is a little bit of other news here as we have a little bit of other time left. Stardom has got a lot going on. They stay in the mix. They stay newsworthy. And I know match-wise, Adam, you know, Dave talked about it a little bit on Observer Radio, very little of it. But with everything going on right now, the five-star taking place and some of the matches you've seen, what do you want to let us know?
Well, really, more than anything, it's that if you, and I'm not paid to say this, not a shill for anybody, but if you don't subscribe to Stardom World, now, particularly that we're at the beginning of the month, would be a hell of a time to do so, because this past week, just in the past few days, Tam Nakano and Nat Sapoy had two matches, one of which on their pay-per-view on June 26th, and then 2 days later, at Korakuen Hall on the 28th, the first being a cage match, the second being just a straight-up one-on-one singles match. They're as good as anything you're going to see in pro wrestling. Really, the biggest struggle I have right now is to try to determine which of those two matches are my match of the year. Right now, I'm thinking that it was the cage match on the 26th, but I could definitely see the argument on, you know, for the match on the 28th. They also had a great singles match last year as well. But just that cage match, like, if you want, there could not be a bigger contrast between that and, let's say, the blood and guts match, in that this cage match, while you had a few sort of dangerous spots, this was so much more a cage match from back in the day, where it was all sort of the hatred and the violence, the sense of urgency, the desperation, the intensity between the two wrestlers. Like, you didn't need to bring in shards of glass and kendo sticks and tables and pull up the padding and go to the top of the cage, because the cage itself and the personalities and the issue between the two, that was that's all you needed. Just, again, go out of your way to watch this. The finish, for one, the rule set was different in that it was both a pinfall and an escape the cage, in that to be eligible to escape the cage, you had to get a pin or a submission. Once you got that, then you could go try to escape the cage. So that lent to sort of a different atmosphere, a different vibe. But the finish with Tam Nakano hitting her version of the Steiner screwdriver, then going to the top, being about to climb over the cage, Natsupoi dramatically pulling herself up and getting to the top of the cage, trying to stop Tam from getting out. And then Tam locking on a sleeper with Natsupoi suspended, her feet off the top rope, just dangling, hanging in midair till she went out and fell down to the mat, being caught by the referee. And then Tam climbing over, getting out, winning the match, and then immediately running to the cage door, like desperately trying to get in, getting them to unlock the cage. The scene post-match where, you know, she's talking to Natsupoi and basically saying, like, we don't need to do this again. That was enough. Natsupoi saying that, you know, I can't stop till I beat you, like basically shoving her away and say, we're doing the match on Tuesday. Just a great scene. And then that leading into the match on the 28th, which was completely different. There was no cage. It started off fast. Every bit the amount of brutality, though, a couple of those body slams on the floor, a few of the kicks from Natsupoi in response to the kicks from Tam Nakano were incredible. We had five of the twisting splashes, the Ferial Gift. Natsupoi hit that five times, and then eventually hits a knee drop version of that twisting splash, and finally got the win over Tam Nakano, the biggest win of Natsupoi's career. Just fantastic stuff. Like I said on Twitter, to me that cage match was the best cage match I'd seen since War Games 1992, which is maybe my favorite match of all time, right up there with Okada versus Shibata from 2017. So if that is an endorsement for me, I don't know what is.
I have nothing to add to that.
Watch the match. Everyone needs to watch that match. Also, go out of your way on the show on the 28th to watch the Hanan versus Tomoko Inaba match, the Future of Stardom Championship match. Great stuff. The best Future of Stardom match has ever been. And Inaba is somebody who, for many reasons, the run she's on right now, obviously being from JTO, Just Tap Out, Takuma Shinoku's group, which continues to churn out great wrestlers that go elsewhere. She's the Sendai Junior Heavyweight Champion. But I'd be very, very surprised if in the next year, particularly when her run with that championship in Sendai Girls Pro is over, I'd be very surprised if we don't see Inaba as one of the next people to join Stardom full-time at some point. And yeah, that show then, you know, that leads into, they've got a few more big things coming up, including on July 9th, yeah, next weekend, the show with Shuri versus Momo Watanabe, continuation of the Tam versus Natsupoi feud with Cosmic Angels against Donna Del Mondo. Also, Saya Kamatani versus Starlight Kid, Izumi versus Momo Gogo. Those are all coming up on the 9th. And then we've got the 5-Star Grand Prix coming up, which we'll get into in much more detail, just as we will with the G1 in coming weeks. But man, you look at the lineup, both the Red Stars and Blue Stars block, and it is absolutely ridiculous the matches that we are going to get over the course of the 5-Star Grand Prix. Even on the first couple nights, there's stuff that just, there's matches that you would think could be, you know, the finals of a tournament, a main event of a big arena show.
Made stars, stars on the come up, young stars, you know, and people in development. Stardom is strong. And
yes,
the qualifying league, which is going on right now, which is leading into that. And yeah, you look at those lineups that they have, and you just look at the reaction that they've gotten for, again, may not be whole shows, but individual matches. And it's like, man, they're just so strong. And I don't know, you know, I don't know what level they can ever get to here, but it doesn't, I don't know how often Shimmer is going to run. You know, it, we are, there is a hole here in the States, even though there's more women probably working more shows than ever right now. There is not that focus on, because again, I don't know if Shine exists anymore or any of that stuff. You know, for women's wrestling here, again, even though some people are on bigger stages now because of AEW and stuff like that, it still doesn't feel, it feels like a Stardom presence could absolutely be used here. And again, I don't know what the future is with Shimmer,
I think we'll get that at some point. Whatever form that takes, how often they come here, I don't know. But I think that's, you know,
because
I think
we will
get that at some point. I should also mention, by the way, the other show coming up in the next few days for Stardom, next week, the New Blood show where they work with other promotions. There's a match that, if you didn't know better, you would think I was the guest booker for this show. It is Mirai versus Suzu Suzuki.
Yeah, really? That was
going
right out
to
of
be
you.
Incredible.
I just, you know, when it comes to, you know, obviously Julia and I think Natsupoi, you know, I wonder if Natsupoi 2023, how it's going to be for her over there. But she could be a star here. And I think,
yes,
you know, there's...
That's the danger is that someone realizes how big of a star Natsupoi could be and throws a bunch of money and gets her away from Stardom. I hope that doesn't happen because I'd be shocked if she isn't the doesn't have the white belt at some point in the next 6 months to a year.
Yeah, the highest Ishidas, the series, the Micahs, you know, they may not be as made for an American audience, but like Natsupoi and her style, I mean, we've seen it with AEW. And again, I know it's somewhat polarizing when it comes to the smaller women that tend to...
It's only polarizing if you're dumb. I'm sorry.
I
don't see how anyone could watch Riho and watch the reactions to Riho every single time she's on AEW television and be quote-unquote polarized in any way.
Because there are normal people that actually have rational minds who go, well, no, I don't like that style and I don't like the way she works as opposed to somebody else. Unfortunately, though... Much like we talked about at the beginning of this with people talking about all-timers, as soon as somebody says something, everybody's got to plant their flag and throw their thing, and it's like that's not necessarily the case. Where, I mean, I would prefer watching, you know, Siri and Utami Hayashishita as opposed to, like, say, Azumi and Starlight Kid flying around. That's just my preference, but
ooh.
I also think... Well, yeah, and again, it comes down to it comes down to personal preference, and that's where I think... Honestly, your Natsupois and some of the people like that, you know, I wonder if you were to just drop Utami Hayashishita in the middle of AEW and you drop Natsupoi, who's going to get over? I can tell you.
Natsupoi would get over more without a doubt.
Not even a question she would.
And not saying that she's better or,
exactly.
or worse or anything, but that character
different
and that
charisma,
style,
yep.
is the entire presentation is something that would immediately get over to an American audience, whereas Hayashishita, I think, eventually would, but I think it would take more. In some ways, it's almost like the difference between, whoever, I'm just trying to think of whoever you could compare it to, but, like, I would look at Hayashishita as someone like Shingo Takagi in the sense that there might not be the immediate reaction, but by the end of the match, people would be going crazy, whereas with Natsupoi and her style, I think it would be immediately like, okay, wow, this person is someone to watch.
And God bless her. I know she probably doesn't want to come back and relive any experiences in America anytime soon, but the thought of Kari Sane at some point coming into work with AEW, that's one of the biggest parts about the relationships with New Japan and everything is, and talking about this show being an all-timer, can you imagine down the line if everybody's available, not only everybody's available, but you actually have Stardom interaction on the show too, or TJP, or we have a weekend of this stuff because
when TJP you mean Tokyo Joshi Pro.
Tokyo Joshi Pro,
TJP.
Yeah. I mean I hope down the line we can get a weekend. I hope they can work with each other and I hope we can get that big type of weekend where we have 2 days of some really incredible stuff happening, you know, and I
well,
and
if
hope,
John
man,
Moxley gets his way,
now.
There'll be a cyber fight version of a Forbidden Door. He's wanting Muto, he's wanting Sakuraba, he's wanting all these different guys coming over, these different people coming over. That obviously, if you looked at Tony Khan when John Moxley was saying that, that's not going to happen. But if that did, you could have a lot of Tokyo Joshi Pro presence. It is crazy that you know, that we had Yuka Sakazaki on just after, you know, it's the same thing with Takeshita too. There's other people that, you know, in a world without politics, yes, would it have been great to have Konosuke Takeshita on this show? Yes, he would have been the best performer on the show, but, you know, you're not going to have that when it's a New Japan AEW show, and sort of the same thing with Yuka Sakazaki, you know, or, you know, Miyu Yamashita or anyone like that. Would it have been awesome to have them on Forbidden Door? Yes, but there was literally no way for that to happen.
And for all you kids out there, a future deep dive idea, when this whole thing is said and done, Konosuke Takeshita, his time in America, deep dive, watch all of the matches that he have, West Coast Pro against Speedball Bailey, his time on Dark Elevation, all that sort of stuff. It's going to be one of those things that'll make for a good compilation later on whatever form things take, MP4, DVD, 8-track,
yeah,
whatever the hell it is.
If top tapes existed, this would be Konosuke Takeshita's overseas vacation, which has been anything but, would certainly be a top candidate.
Hey, look, 85 minutes into this show, we could do 85 more minutes, but unfortunately, schedules do not allow that. So we will be back very, very soon talking about a variety of different things. Who knows? Maybe some matches have been added to the Great Muta Retirement Tour, but there's plenty of other things that we're going to need to be getting into.
There's a good chance that the next show we do will be the world-famous, ballyhooed G1 preview. We're just a few weeks away. We're, 15 days away from the start of the G1. So very soon, be on the lookout for that. Alert your ears. We will review, or I should say preview, every single match in the 28-man field of the G1. God help us.
I wonder if it'll be easier or harder this year with the four blocks and the,
Well, the thing that's going to be much harder, I can tell you right now, doing math on the fly, where on every show it's like one match from block A, two matches from block B, one match from block C, one match from block D. That is going to be a challenge.
Yes, if we please somebody have an abacus going, but Adam,
a sundial will be in effect. We will do this show live and direct from Stonehenge.
I will let you close the show out with the amount of money, your admission of how much money, because I haven't asked you this, that you spent on merch this past weekend at Forbidden Door.
I actually spent $0 on merch this weekend because I spent so much money on merch. Not that much, but because I spent a decent amount of money on merch at the Windy City Riot show. I bought a shirt and I bought a towel at Windy City Riot. So I cannot bring myself to spend more money for the merch at the actual Forbidden Door show. The wallet was my Forbidden Door.
Can I borrow that towel to cry in for all of my sports teams?
It's same here. Come on, things are rough here in Chicago as well on the sports front, but in any event, we will close it out, as always, let you know about a few different things that we have going on. Jeremy Deemer and I, who I mentioned earlier, attended Forbidden Door with me. We do the Wrestling at Random podcast. We are in the waning days of the break between season 3 and the upcoming season 4. We continue to do bonus podcasts on our Patreon each and every week during the season break. We just reviewed AWA Wrestling for a Cure with the worst play-by-play man in the history of pro wrestling was on the call for that show, Eddie Andelman with Killer Kowalski. My God, was it awful, but it was a fun watch, a fun review.
Is that the Long Riders and Road Warriors?
Yes, where the Long Riders dominate the match and the Road Warriors hit one move and win.
Wow.
One of the strangest matches I've ever seen.
I'll be damned. Just, that's awesome.
There's also an 8-minute time limit draw between Nick Bockwinkel and Rick Martel. Because you had to get those guys out of the ring so you could go to the main event of Sergeant Slaughter and Boris Zukov. It was quite the show. So that gives you an idea of the sort of oddball stuff that we review there. In the next few weeks, we'll be back doing shows as well on the free feed for Wrestling at Random. If you search Wrestling at Random on the very same place you're getting this podcast right now, you can go back and see all, I should say, and listen to all the previous episodes of that show. Some nearly 100 episodes there for you to listen to, evergreen content. So there's that. There's also the 3-Count Fall newsletter, which will be returning to its regular format very soon. I should have a new issue, maybe somewhat abbreviated, but a new issue out in the next few days. And then we'll get back to the weekly schedule As my move is nearly completed, I am settled in and ready to get back into the swing of things on that front. You can subscribe there. AdamSummers.substack.com. Get ready to get the new issues that will be coming there. And I know, Mike, you, as always, have a few other things in the hopper, in the mix as well.
Yeah, you know, always a lot going on. Again, if you didn't get enough of Adam and I talking about this show and you want to hear me talk about this show a little bit more, Sports Guys Talking Wrestling Podcast over at the Horn, ESPN in Austin, Texas, with Stu Myrick. He has me on all the time there, and I greatly enjoyed doing that show. That's available on via podcast and on YouTube as the Mid-Atlantic Championship Podcast. Also is midatlanticpod.com. We go week by week through the Peacock archives of Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling. We were up January 29th, 1983 was just recorded. The road to Greensboro continues between Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood against Sergeant Slaughter and Don Kernoodle. We also have Greg Valentine and Dick Slater tearing the studio apart every week in battles against Roddy Piper. So there is a lot of fun stuff going on right now in Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling. Love that show. Love doing that Twitter feed at Mid-Atlantic Pod. We got social media on several platforms. We also have a Patreon as well too, but that Twitter feed I love doing every day, almost every day. That's Mid-Atlantic Pod there. So that's pretty much all I got going on other than Wrestling Observer Live right now. Shout out to the homies, blackwrestling.com. They always got something going on there. Hope to do something with them very soon as well, too. So until we talk to you again on this show, there are plenty of ways to hear Adam and I.
Absolutely. So with that, we'll close it out. We'll close the forbidden door, but much like Yoshihashi and Hirooki Goto, we might step back through it at any given time. We somehow, I have no idea how this happened, but we somehow forgot to mention Katsuyori Shibata showing up at Forbidden Door, coming out after the conclusion of the Will Ospreay Orange Cassidy match, making the save for Orange Cassidy of all people. Man, it was something to see Katsuyori Shibata in the ring, throwing kicks, throwing drop kicks, throwing dudes around, putting the sunglasses on with Orange Cassidy. Pretty much the last person in the world I would have expected him to interact with in New Japan. But it was so much fun, and just seeing Shibata coming out, hearing that music hit, and seeing him on the rampway, hearing the reaction from the crowd, which, you know, again, we talked about earlier, for a guy who, you know, you would think maybe not the most well-known guy to American audiences, but the fans reacted to him as an absolute star, as a legend, as they should have, and just total chills, total goosebumps. I go back to the New York weekend in 2019, WrestleMania weekend, where went to a bunch of shows, including the New Japan Ring of Honor co-promoted show at Madison Square Garden, and having the opportunity to meet Shibata and just see him in person and see that he was okay. And, you know, everything we've seen down the line with him since then, including that match with Ren Narita at Wrestle Kingdom this year, to see him in person, if not in a match, just doing some physical things, having some physicality, throwing dudes around, like I said. So cool. Another thing to scratch off the bucket list. So excited to see where Shibata goes next in terms of in New Japan, if we get another proper match out of him. He seemed to be indicating wanting a match with Will Ospreay as that whole segment was closing out of the pay-per-view. So we shall see. But even if it was just a self-contained thing for, you know, for the people that ordered the pay-per-view and the live crowd, so much fun. So glad it happened. As I said earlier, so glad I was able to attend Forbidden Door. And with that, now we'll actually close it out. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.